You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump has deployed federal law enforcement agents with the stated goal of helping to stop violence by demonstrators in Portland, Oregon. Other cities, including Milwaukee, may be next. Coming up, we'll explore the limits of a president's power to use federal forces in states and cities. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported 1,117 new cases of COVID-19 yesterday. That sets a record for the most new cases in a single day and comes as the state's seven-day average of positive tests has been climbing for about a month. As of yesterday, 859 Wisconsinites have died from COVID-19. Today's numbers, the cases went down some from that record. Dr. Nasia Safdar is Medical Director for Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She's also a professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Safdar, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, I know I get hung up on the day-to-day numbers sometimes. They don't always tell the whole story that jumps from one day to the next. What are you watching when it comes to the overall trends here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think that there's a couple things to remember with viral replication and the way the pandemic spreads. And case count is an important number to keep in mind. The factor I think that's most important is that it's exponential spread. And so there's doubling every few days. And the longer the time that you can take the virus to double, the better it is. But that isn't what we're seeing at the moment. And sometimes people forget that it's the doubling that is happening. And so we get surprised when the case count suddenly rises very high when really it was to be expected.
What is behind this rise that we're seeing?
Well, I think that physical mobility seems to have played a major role in seeing this gradually increasing case count ever since the Safer at Home stopped happening. And I think that another thing that we're seeing is that the case count is very much prevalent in the younger demographic, and that is also a population that moves around quite a bit.
I've seen people say that that people dying of COVID-19 is kind of a lagging indicator. When you see the cases go up, as we've seen in some other states anyway, we see a rising death toll a couple weeks later. Is that a fear you have here in Madison as we see these higher case numbers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's a lagging indicator, but it is an indicator that we need to monitor very closely, because even if, you know, the younger, somewhat healthier population is getting cases now, eventually transmission will happen to those who are vulnerable and older as well.
Now, I know nobody wants to get COVID-19. That said, have we seen improvements in treatment, especially in hospitals?
Well, hospitalized patients, yes. There's now several options for treatment. There's the convalescent plasma that you can get from people who have recovered from COVID-19. There is remdesivir, which reduces the length of hospitalization in ill people. And there's steroid use in critically ill people as well, all of which have shown benefit.
That said, this is still not something to mess around with. These are not 100% cures. These are not things that prevent all the damage of COVID-19. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. I think that there is absolutely no substitute to prevention in this case. And the sheer toll that COVID-19 takes on your body and the recovery time, and, you know, it's just so much better to not get it in the first place.
We're talking to Dr. Nasia Safdar, Medical Director for Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics and Professor in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest numbers and trends when it comes to COVID-19 here in the state. Dr. Safdar, if people are worried again or worried maybe for the first time about trying to prevent COVID-19, what is your advice for them right now?
I think the things that we know work should be implemented consistently and with high fidelity. And that means masking, it means physical distancing, and it means really following public health advice about isolation and quarantine. Those measures, you know, just as growth is exponential, so is the return to a more decent, favorable growth rate if we implement all these interventions. So we have an opportunity to make a difference here.
We've been focusing on Wisconsin for the most part. Nationally, we saw, I think, the death toll yesterday hit the 1,000 mark for the first time in about 6 weeks or so, almost said months, 6 weeks or so. What are the areas around the country that you're watching the most closely?
I think Florida is a state that we're watching closely. Arizona and Texas, I think, have also had, and now California is experiencing a number of cases. And there are things to be learned from the experience of all these states, but I think the one common thing that we're seeing is that the more there is confusion and discussion and debate about the value of interventions that we know now should work, like masking and physical distancing, the less of an opportunity you have to curtail this pandemic.
And people are hoping for a vaccine. What is your, I guess, hopeful time frame for a vaccine to go through all the testing process, the production process, and be something that can start making a difference in the public?
I think much sooner than for other pandemics in the past. There are several candidates that are already, have completed early trials and are looking promising and safe. And so phase 3 trials are beginning and are already undergoing in some other parts of the world. So if we find that it's a safe and efficacious vaccine, then I think the next big challenge will be manufacturing enough to give it to a large population in the world. And of course, what that means for allocation in the U.S. remains to be determined.
I should bring in another element to all of this. We've seen an increase, it looks like, if I'm reading things right, in testing here in Wisconsin. Are we hitting the testing levels that you'd hope to see so we know how bad the disease is here in the state?
Yeah, I think testing capacity has improved pretty dramatically. There probably still are pockets within Wisconsin where it's not all the same. But having said that, compared to when we started out, yes, it's much, much better.
And then how about the next step? And we've talked about some of this on the show recently, contact tracing and making sure that people with the positive test do all they can to not spread the disease to other people. Do we have room for improvement there?
Yeah, I think the challenge there is that it's a very time-sensitive situation. If you can't connect with the contacts right after you know that they're a potential contact, then, they may have had the opportunity to spread the disease further. So if we have the infrastructure and the manpower to be able to do aggressive contact tracing, which for some counties in Wisconsin we do and for others we don't, that would be very helpful.
Dr. Softar, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Nasha Softar is Medical Director for Infection Control at UW Hospital and Clinics. She was with us today to talk about COVID-19 trends in Wisconsin after the state reported a record number of new cases yesterday. The number dipped some in today's report from the state. Coming up, we'll talk with a filmmaker from Milwaukee about her new documentary looking into the life of famous television astrologer Walter Mercado. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a Milwaukee native who directed a new documentary about television's most famous astrologer. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about survival.
Dreaming can help some people get through incredibly difficult times. Madison's Tundalea Taylor talks about how daydreaming helped her overcome a major health crisis and appreciate everyday life.
You want to know what I love? I love traveling, great earrings and purses. I mean, who wouldn't love to shop every day, all day, with not a care or worry in the world? I envision myself walking through the airport with my favorite pair of Black Queen earrings, my cute matching crossbody purse, taking a first-class flight to the Bahamas. I find myself doing that all too often. When I daydream, it was starting to affect my day job. Daydreaming was good to me until I had an unexpected visitor that would put my daydreaming into jeopardy. I had been feeling horrible for a few months. I was so tired, I almost couldn't make it to the doctor appointment. Finally dragged myself to the doctor. Never planned out in my mind that I would drive to the doctor, but I would ride in the ambulance to the emergency room. Mm. 8 hours later, one doctor came in and said, "You look good compared to what your body is going through, so we're going to keep you overnight." I suddenly had a sigh of relief. After another doctor came in and told me he ran every test he could possibly run, and he said I had leukemia. Mm. Then I called my mom and said they think I have cancer, even though he was truly sure that's what it was. I called my mama because I wanted her to call him and tell him about himself. Don't be telling her baby she got cancer. Like that one time she told the school worker not to be talking down on her kids. Or like that one time she told our babysitter, "Don't tell us, we can't eat our food." Then finally moved to my first room after being admitted into the hospital. It was the ICU. It was never told to me what stage cancer I was in. I was always told it's aggressive. After 8 rounds of chemo, after 2 bone marrow tests, after various trips to the hospital for infections, after losing my hair, after 4 non-successful tries of getting stem cells, after telling my son I had cancer, after not having an appetite, after many restless nights, after not being able to daydream about traveling to places with no signs of cold weather anywhere, I finally got good news. Besides finding out the chemo was working, there was no evidence of the disease. I got stem cells. I made them on my own with the booster shot, of course. For these new stem cells I was about to receive, I'm going in the hospital for 1 month, take chemo for 7 days. This may have been the hardest chemo I have ever gotten, but I made it to transplant day. Wipe my system out and receive a new beginning. It's like filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy in my body. I wanted to go home and heal there. I'm living my life after cancer. I enjoy every day as my last because I don't know how much time I have here. Wow. One thing I was always worried about is if the cancer will ever come back. The thing about cancer is that it's not a cure, so I'm not fully cured of cancer. I'm just living my life like it doesn't exist. This time when I daydream is really to take the trip to the Bahamas with my new surviving cancer earrings and I survived cancer t-shirt. The biggest daydream is really a reality because it involves being cancer free.
Tondalea Taylor's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project. Taylor was also a guest on the new podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, for anyone who watched Spanish language television during the 1970s, 80s, or 90s, this is probably a very familiar voice.
Y que reciban de mí siempre paz, mucha paz, pero sobre todo mucho, mucho, mucho qué? Amor.
Lots of peace and love there from the late television astrologer Walter Mercado, subject of the new documentary Mucho, Mucho Amor. Besides delivering the daily horoscopes, Mercado became famous for his gender-bending style and flashy wardrobe. At the peak of his popularity, he reached more than 100 million viewers a day. Christina Costantini is a Milwaukee native and co-director of Mucho Mucho Amor, which is streaming now on Netflix. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
First, I wanted to ask about your personal memories growing up in Milwaukee. What are some of your first memories of seeing Walter Mercado on TV?
Well, you know, whenever my grandmother would babysit me, I would go over to her house and Univision was on. And, you know, my dad is from Argentina. She's from Argentina. And so, you know, I would be hanging out with her and all of a sudden this magical, mystical person would come on the television. And I had never seen anyone like Walter before. You know, Walter kind of looks like he's kind of in the Liberace camp, I would say. But he's an astrologer who would tell the Latin community all across Latin America and in the U.S. that tomorrow was going to be a better day. And he read our horoscopes and he could tell the future. And I was just mesmerized by him. I mean, he had incredible capes and magnificent hair and his jewelry was incredible. And so I remember just thinking, who is this wizard? And why is my grandmother so obsessed with what he's telling us? And so as a child, I was fascinated by him for many reasons. But as an adult, I think I gained a new appreciation for him, which was, you know, during those times to look androgynous or what we would call now gender queer, it's just so radical. And to do that in a homophobic and machista culture like the Latin culture is incredible. And so I set out to find him and see what he was up to. And, you know, he had basically disappeared from the mainstream and no one had seen him in a long time. And so my friends and I, Kareem Tapsch, my co-director, and Alex Fumero, our producer, we found him. And so that the film is the story of of what happened to him, where he went, and what he's doing now. And it was a real privilege to be able to spend two years with him.
And for people who grew up with Spanish language media, he was a legend. For people who didn't, we might not know as much about him. But, you know, you have some, like, kind of big names in a documentary meeting him, and they are starstruck meeting Walter Mercado.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we say that he's kind of like if Mr. Rogers and Oprah were one person, but dressed like Liberace. That's the cultural significance of Walter Mercado. And so in our film, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda is in our film. He grew up watching Walter, and he kind of in the film is a stand-in for the rest of us. It's really like, you know, going to the North Pole and meeting Santa Claus. You can't overstate what a big deal it is for a Latin child, someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, to meet Walter. He is like Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy. You know, this amazing, incredible persona that he kind of occupies our imagination and our memories in this really nostalgic way.
And one more thing before we get to meeting him in the modern day, his message is just like the title of the movie, lots and lots of love he brings to people. And he just relentlessly positive message that he brought to his astrology.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I think as an adult listening back to his horoscopes, I've started to realize that they all kind of sound the same. It was like Libra. Tomorrow's going to be better. Sagittarius, things were hard, but they also will get better. And I think for an immigrant community who's you know, come to this country with not a lot of money, you know, many of us did not know the language. You know, we're working very, very hard to make ends meet. I think that message of love and hope was incredibly important. And I think we all needed that message of love and hope during those years. And I think the movie is resonating with people because I think during these times that we live in, we all could use a little bit more love and a little bit more hope.
We're talking to Christina Costantini. She's from Milwaukee, and she's co-director of Mucho Mucho Amor, streaming now on Netflix. Okay, so Christina, you get to meet this legendary figure for you and so many other people. What was it like just to be with him and talk to him, as you said, over the course of 2 years in person?
It was really incredible. You know, people tell you that you should never meet your heroes because they're never what you want them to be. But I think Walter is maybe the rare exception. He is so full of love, so kind. It's hard to really to describe it in words, but he makes you feel very special. Like, you know, he always cared more about other people than he did about himself. You know, he loves himself. You'll see in the film, he loves himself, but he always loved you more. And I think he had a real way of making us all feel worthy and important and loved.
Was there a dividing line between Walter Mercado, real person, and Walter Mercado, the performance, or did it all just kind of blur together?
You know, we would always ask his family members that. We would always, as we were filming, we were like, when is Walter going to let us really show us the real Walter? When are we going to meet the real Walter? And after 2 years of saying that, they were like, you know, it strikes us like you have met the real Walter. He's maybe not as fabulous as he was on television every day. You know, he doesn't wear those capes around the house, but he really is quite glamorous. A story that I love is his 5-year-old great grandniece was 5-week-old great grandniece rather was coming to his house to meet him, and he wouldn't let the baby into his room until he had his hair and makeup completely done. He didn't want the 5-week-old to remember him as anything but, you know, who he feels like he is inside, which is the person who he showed us every day on television, this like ethereal being of light that is very elegant and very fabulous. So I love that story. I think that's exactly how he was. He loved being fabulous.
And things aren't always easy for Walter. It sounds like he got taken advantage of through his career by unscrupulous managers, a thing that happens, I guess, in the entertainment world. This isn't somebody who, you know, became a super millionaire despite this international fame.
Yeah, you know, Walter went through hard times too, and I think that is part of the story. But Walter didn't like focusing on anything negative. And so it was quite a process of trying to get him to talk about anything that had gone wrong in his life. But of course, you know, he has been away from the public eye for so long because things ended quite tragically between him and his manager. But we find him at a time when he's trying to kind of plot a mini comeback of sorts. So, you know, he's trying to return. When we were making the movie, we thought it was a comeback, and it turned out to be a swan song. He passed away shortly after us filming with him. So we felt very lucky to be able to capture that moment of his life. It was just such a privilege to be with such a loving person for that period of time.
And that message of mucho, mucho amor, it sounds like he took that with him to the end.
Exactly. Yeah, he really lived by his message every day. He was one of the kindest people I've ever met, and you know, I'm sure he's in the stars somewhere, very excited that his film is out and his legacy is documented. So we hope everybody will check it out on Netflix.
Christina, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Christina Costantini is a film producer and director originally from Milwaukee. She talked to us about her latest film, Mucho, Mucho Amor, a documentary about the career of the television astrologer Walter Mercado. It's streaming now on Netflix. Coming up, we'll look at the legal arguments for and against President Trump's use of federal agents to quell violence in American cities. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, the head of Wisconsin's Transportation Department joins the show for a look at efforts to revive an I-94 construction plan. Find out more tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Trump administration is mulling plans to send federal officers to cities nationwide in an effort, they say, to quell anti-police protests and to deal with violent crime. The president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, said agents could even be deployed in Wisconsin. Here's a clip of Meadows on Fox News Channel over the weekend.
And you'll see something rolled out this week as we start to go in and make sure that the communities, whether it's Chicago or Portland or Milwaukee or someplace across the heartland of the country, we need to make sure that our communities are safe.
In a statement, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett said he hasn't received any info about federal intervention in the city, that Milwaukee's protests have largely been peaceful, and that the Fed's presence would be counterproductive. Today, President Trump announced he's sending a surge of federal law enforcement officers to Chicago. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said the operation would not be similar to that in Portland, Oregon. Local and state leaders there say agents disregarded local rules and expectations about wearing identification, using tear gas, and crowd control. So how much authority does a president have when it comes to deploying federal forces to U.S. cities? Claire Finkelstein is the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law and a Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's faculty director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. She's the author of several books. They include Sovereignty and the New Executive Authority, Ethics, National Security, and the Rule of Law, and has written elsewhere about these issues. Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems like there's two different paths here on what these law enforcement agencies, federal law enforcement agents would be doing. Let's start with the Portland case. We've seen these long-running protests, some riots in Portland, and now we've got these Homeland Security enforcement officials there. What is your read on that situation, first of all?
Well, let's be really clear. The actions of these so-called federal agents is violating several layers of law here. First of all, it violates the Constitution, the rights of peaceful protesters to assemble. And for the most part, that's what it's been in Portland. to be arrested when they are exercising their First Amendment rights is unconscionable in a free democracy. It also violates their Fifth and 14th Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution, not to mention the 10th Amendment, because the state is not welcoming this intervention. Oregon Governor Kate Brown was very clear that the presence of federal agents is not welcome, and there is no reason to suppose that the situation there is so out of hand that we have an insurrection, which would justify the use of federal troops to march in. So this is not a legal action on the part of the federal government. They are not conducting themselves like lawful agents, although apparently there were some reports of their attempting to read people their rights. They are not observing the law enforcement protocol, and they are not trained to do that. These are not valid law enforcement agents, and they have no business being there.
The argument, at least initially, was that, okay, there are federal facilities in the zone of these protests. We are sending these federal agents there primarily to protect these facilities, federal buildings and whatnot, and we can pursue beyond those if we need to. What do you make of that justification?
It's very interesting because, you know, the executive order that President Trump signed, I think, last week, protecting monuments, may be a sort of lead-in to this, right? Because he is, in effect, suggesting that wherever there is a monument, in particular Confederate monuments that he wants to protect, he will be entitled to come in and use federal troops to protect those monuments, given that there's an executive order. But while there is a limited federal law enforcement power to protect federal property, it is much more limited than the way that these agents are behaving. So they are wandering around Portland, picking people up nowhere near federal property. That is not justified as part of the protection of that federal property. Moreover, it is transparently pretextual. So when you are using the protection of federal property as a pretext for violating people's constitutional rights, it is not valid under federal law, and the law cannot be stretched that far.
I want to give a listen to Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler on CNN last night, saying there's no reason, he thought, for the feds to get involved in the first place, and arguing that they're making the situation worse.
Oh, this is just crazy. We were coming to the end of our nightly demonstrations, at least the part where people were vandalizing thing and some scattered acts of violence. But we saw the energy coming out of that. We thought it would be done in a couple of days. But then the federal government sent in dozens, if not hundreds, of troops. They engaged in what I would describe as really abhorrent tactics. And basically, they blew the lid off of this. Since they've been here, we've had huge crowds come downtown. We've had more violence. We've had more violence. They basically kicked the hornet's nest.
So your thoughts, that's not so much on the legal side of things, Claire, but on the outcome.
Yeah, I want to be really clear about this. Remember early on in the protests, there were reports of right-wing agitators in the crowds trying to turn the demonstrations violent. This is an old technique, right? If the loosely organized right-wing supremacists, white supremacists in this country, are trying to undo the left, what they do is they send agitators into a crowd in order to turn that crowd violent, and then have a basis for suppression and saying, look, you know, this discredits the Black Lives Matter movement. What's so frightening about that is that what we see is here in Portland for the first time is the federal government taking on the functions of those loosely organized non-governmental agitators who were trying to discredit a peaceful protest movement. And that's something that we know from history. We know it from 1933 with brown shirts coming in sent by Hitler's government. to try to discredit those who would oppose their efforts and have an excuse to restore law and order. It is a frightening series of developments, and mayors and governors all over the country are bracing themselves for this to be reproduced in their cities.
Talking to Clara Finkelstein, professor of law and professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about the use of federal law enforcement agents against protesters in places like Portland and with the stated goal in other cities of trying to turn the tide on violent crime. You can join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to that other thread now. President Trump at a law enforcement roundtable at the White House had criticized recently the city of Chicago and its violence and vowed to act as he did today. Here's a listen.
When you have 20 people killed, 22 people killed in one weekend in Chicago, and you have 88 shootings, it's not even conceivable. That's worse than Afghanistan, I hate to say it. That's worse than any war zone that we're in by a lot. It makes them look like tame places by comparison, so we're not going to let it go on. We're not supposed to wait for them to call, but they don't call.
So the president today saying, yes, he's sending law enforcement agents to Chicago and Albuquerque trying to help crack down on violent crime. A different theme, but similar agency officials, I think. Is this different or do you see similar problems?
It's very similar. And let's be really clear about what's going on here. There is no justification under federal law either for using federal troops in this way, because it violates what's called the Posse Comitatus Act, or the general principle of Posse Comitatus. It's a fancy word that really just means federal troops, the military, should not be involved in local law enforcement. Now, there is some limited justification for getting federal agents involved. So you remember that President Trump a few weeks ago declared Antifa a domestic terrorist organization. That may have been an attempt to set up just what we see here, namely to say we're routing out terrorism. Terrorism is a federal crime. Therefore, we can send in federal agents to try to crack down on what is a federal crime. Only it turns out there is no justification for declaring a domestic federal terrorist organization. We only do that with foreign organizations. So this is very much a manipulation of federal law to try to find a basis for sending in federal agents. I should also point out that there are the techniques that have been used, such as using tear gas, violate state law because there is a local police, there is a local ordinance banning local police from using tear gas in place in Portland right now. That, you know, these agents, unless they have a federal legal argument for preempting local law, are actually subject to local law. And so they don't have any justification for using techniques that violate local ordinances as well as federal constitutional law and background federal law like posse comitatus.
We're talking about the limits of a president's power to use federal forces and agents in U.S. cities and states. Clara Finkelstein is with us, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, director there of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about President Trump sending federal agents to tackle protests in Portland and maybe other cities and now to address violent crime in other American cities? Do you think it's the right call? Do you worry about the legal justification, the precedent? Call in with your questions and reactions. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Trump administration's decision to send in federal agents to Portland, Oregon, and now other cities. Claire Finkelstein is with us, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, author of books including Sovereignty and the New Executive Authority, Ethics, National Security, and the Rule of Law. You could join in with your questions and reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now. Daryl is with us in Madison. Daryl, hi.
Cyril, this is Cyril. Hi.
Cyril, hi. Go ahead.
A comment about this latest strategy. I believe that the president's use of federal agents from various bureaus and departments of the federal government is an end run tactic because he was unable to utilize regular U.S. Army forces to quell the protests several weeks ago, and that because he was unable to do that, he is now using non-military but still federal controlled personnel.
Cyril, thanks a lot for the call. Claire, what do you think an end run effectively, Cyril says, around the president's inability to use actual army troops?
Well, he does have a point, because look what happened in D.C. in Lafayette Park. There was a use of federal troops for that. And General Milley was later extremely sorry that he had participated in that in any way and allowed that to occur. Again, there is this very firm principle of posse comitatus, which says you may not use federal troops for civilian law enforcement. But I think if you look from the sort of 20,000 foot view here and squint your eyes, it sort of doesn't matter which federal agents or troops are being used, because all of them are illegal. And so it's you know, the president and I believe the attorney general, whose fingerprints are really all over this, are just using any means they can, basically, to oppose state authority, to try to gain an advantage in the election by portraying the you know, the movement in the country right now, which is so important, so significant, as a bunch of left-wing agitators, to try to portray himself as the law and order president. And so I think he will use any means at his disposal. And what's really important when you look at this compared to past events, such as the riots in Los Angeles following the Rodney King verdict, there was a huge difference there, because in that case, local law enforcement officials requested the federal assistance and said, hey, Los Angeles is out of control. We can't get this out of control. Will you come help us? Here, what's so important is that the president is once again attacking the authority and trying to undercut the governors of the various states, especially Democratic governors, states that have a strong Democratic population, which is why in recent threats he is talking about sending federal troops or federal agents into a string of cities, including my own city of Philadelphia.
Thanks for the call, Cyril. We'll go now to Suzette in Oconomowoc. Suzette, hi.
Hi. So because Trump is doing this already, I mean, it's illegal, but he's already doing it, and he seems to do quite a lot of things that are illegal. What has to happen to stop it? I mean, this is, you know, I never thought I would see this. I'm almost 6 years old. I never thought I would see this, and it's really terrifying to a lot of us. How do you stop this president who flies in the face of law all the time? You know, how do we make this not turn into Hitler's Germany?
Well, that is a wonderful question. And of course, the best way to stop him is to vote him out of office in November and for as many people to turn out as possible and make their voices heard. Before then, for example, let's imagine what may happen. In my own city, Philadelphia, our district attorney, Larry Krasner, has said that any federal law enforcement officers who unlawfully try to arrest people, they will face criminal charges from his office. That is considered an assault. It may also be kidnapping. So in addition to the other constitutional rights that they are violating and the possible civil actions that could result from this, we are potentially talking about local law enforcement treating federal agents as criminals. Now, this sort of brings us back to a, you know, reverse civil war almost, or really, the time of the civil rights movement when federal troops were deploying, the National Guard was deployed to try to enforce civil rights laws and decisions that had been made, court decisions, and one can think of Brown v. Board of Education in particular. But in those cases, the federal government was on the side of individual constitutional rights. And here it's the federal government that is violating those rights, and the state governors are trying to protect them. So it's an extremely interesting but also dangerous time in our country, and there are ways to fight back.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Clara Finkelstein from the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the president's use of various federal Homeland Security agents in Portland and elsewhere. Now, Chad Wolf, acting Secretary of Homeland Security, said, I'm going to quote a little bit, these officers are not stormtroopers. They're not the Gestapo, as some have described them. That description is offensive. It's hyperbolic and it's dishonest. And he goes on, he looks forward to the day that officers are redeployed back to the regular day-to-day mission, but they have this duty because of the violence. So argument from the Trump administration that these concerns are overblown and hyperbolic.
In my view, the actions, as I've already expressed, are so patently illegal that the attempts to justify this on the part of federal officials is problematic, to the point that I think Congress should be conducting impeachment inquiries at this point. After Lafayette Park already, the spectacle of federal troops being deployed and federal agents alongside DC police firing rubber bullets and using pepper spray or tear gas, we're still not sure which, in Lafayette Park was so appalling on peaceful demonstrators just so that the president could cross Lafayette Park and get a photo op with a Bible in front of the church. So I think that this is really a moment in which we need to see mayors and governors fighting back. We need to give them our strongest possible support. But at the same time, I really think that this is also a moment when our federal officials have to be held to account, and in particular, the Attorney General, where he is supposed to be the repository of the rule of law in this country. If he is violating the law, he needs to be investigated for that, and that will strengthen Congress's hand to get the information it needs to find out exactly what's going on here.
Time for one more quick call. Logan is with us in Green Bay. Logan, hello.
Hi. In most countries, the military cannot be used within the country to quell an insurrection if this is leads to anything like that. Trump is capable of anything. What happens when he uses it, when he loses the election and uses the military for his own purpose to declare the election null and void?
Logan, thanks for the call. Just a half minute or so, Claire, concerns that President Trump would use similar methods if he lost the election.
I fear that Logan is right to be concerned. However, I want to say I have a lot of faith in our military ultimately. They receive excellent training in the rule of law, and they take an oath to uphold the Constitution and to defend the Constitution, and an oath that they take seriously. Unlike some of our federal officials, I do not believe that our military would lend itself to such efforts. And I think that if Donald Trump loses in November, that we will see our military clearly on the side of the right of succession and validating the election.
Thanks to our guest today, Clara Finkelstein, professor of law and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, looking at the Trump administration's use of federal agents in U.S. cities with the stated goal of stopping violence in those communities. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this summer isn't the travel season many were hoping for. We'll get advice on staying safe when we do travel. You can join in with your questions and your experiences. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Reverend Alex G. joins the show with some suggestions on how to talk about issues of race and racism with your family. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we've been living on stockpiled TV shows thanks to advanced production schedules in the entertainment world. But after months of halted production and lots of uncertainty, what will happen to our entertainment options? A television reporter brings us some of the latest. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.